everyone. Welcome to another episode of East Coast, a true crime podcast, where I tell you about unsolved cases from Florida to Maine and throw in a few solved cases in between. I'm your host, Allie, and first and foremost, I have a few changes I'm going to announce. I've decided to move to posting a podcast every other week, and I am also going to try and make all the episodes a little bit longer to make up for it. Today, I am covering a case that is heartbreaking. I'm pretty sure I say that every podcast, and I will probably say that every podcast moving forward, but this case involves a young boy, and anytime children are involved, my heart breaks a little. This case is, you probably guessed it, from the 1980s. At this point, should I just change the podcast to a 1980s true crime podcast? I won't, but it is tempting. But that also got me thinking about why the 80s tend to pop up whenever I'm researching cases. Bear with me as I go off on a little bit of a tangent, but I think if you're as interested in true crime as I am, you might be fascinated to know this little bit as well. The BBC wrote an article about why the rise in serial killers happened in the 1980s. While we won't be talking about a serial killer for this case we're discussing today, I thought that they covered a lot of really good points as to why we see cases from the 1980s going unsolved. Quote, society at the time was undergoing major changes. People were moving more and were less likely to know their neighbors. Hitchhiking was more common, making it easier for killers to find vulnerable victims. End quote. While that doesn't directly tie to the case I'm going to be talking about in a few minutes, it does help to show why we did have so many murders back then. A lot of cases we have talked about in the past involve hitchhiking. But why did so many of the cases from the 1980s go unsolved? The BBC touches on that as well, saying, quote, police lacked large-scale computerized databases and investigative data banks that could help them link similar crimes. DNA wasn't used until the mid-1980s, for forensic purposes, making it harder to track killers, end quote. A lot of which we knew. I mean, just watch an episode of Criminal Minds. Could they solve a single case without any of the technology we use today? While that isn't a great example because Criminal Minds is just a TV show, I think it's an apt analogy. Police rely on a lot of the increases in technology to solve crimes. And still, there are so many that are unsolved even now with the technology. So, yeah. I wonder if some of the cases in the 80s might have actually been solved if they had access to the technology we have today. I wonder if it may have even helped in this case. The case we're going to be talking about today is the disappearance of 4-year-old Jeremy Grice on November 22, 1985, from Aiken County, South Carolina. He lived in a trailer with his mom, Donna, stepdad, Nick, and his 7-month-old little sister. The day prior had been like any other. Donna had put him on the bus for him to go to pre-K at Jefferson Elementary School in Bath. She and Jeremy had learned some sign language after seeing a television show on the hearing impaired. Her last communication with her son was actually him signing the words, "I love you," from the bus. She went to work later on in the day and wouldn't be home until 1 a.m. on the 22nd. Nick, his stepfather, made Jeremy his dinner after Jeremy had come home from school and eventually tucked him into bed. Everything that morning and that whole day felt fine. Donna returned home around 1 a.m. and went to bed. I don't know if she checked on him after she got home, but I do know that around 7 a.m., according to postandcourier.com, she woke up to make coffee for her husband and check on Jeremy from afar. From the same Post and Courier article, quote, on her way back to bed, she stopped by Jeremy's room to check on him as he slept. Past articles state that she didn't actually see Jeremy, but saw the covers on his bed rumpled in a heap. Jeremy had a habit of burrowing under the covers when he slept, so she thought nothing of it. End quote. She woke around 10 a.m. to her 7-month-old crying and then realized that Jeremy was not home. She searched the whole mobile home before calling the police. They were there within an hour. The last sighting of Jeremy was thought to be by the next-door neighbor, who saw Jeremy outside around 8:45 a.m. playing with his dog, and he had his bike nearby, almost as if, according to the Charlie Project, that he was going to school. But he didn't have school that day. Donna thought that was odd, that he'd be out there playing. There was pretty bad weather, apparently, so it didn't seem right. According to a clipping from a newspaper called The Item out of Sumter, South Carolina, Jeremy was actually terrified of the rain. His mother says in that same article from The Item, quote, "There's no way Jeremy just wandered off. There were animal crackers and suckers left on the kitchen table that morning that Jeremy would have gotten into when we woke up. He never leaves the house without the jacket his daddy bought him at the racetrack. And more than anything else, it was raining when he disappeared, and Jeremy was scared to death of the rain. He didn't leave this trailer. Somebody came in here and got him." End quote. He left his favorite jacket and shoes inside, and the dog he was spotted with outside? Well, that dog apparently never left his side. And that dog was home. It wasn't reported, well, at least not that I can tell, if the dog was inside or outside the home when Donna woke up. At least it wasn't reported by any newspaper that I could find. But the Charlie Project lists that the dog was inside, so I'm gonna lean towards that most likely being correct. The sheriff's office organized a search. They set up a 3-mile perimeter around the mobile home. The list of people who showed up is pretty long, at least according to Post and Courier, quote, "Men and women from the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, the South Carolina Wildlife and Marine Resources Department, and the Aiken County Sheriff's Office combed through the woods and fields surrounding the Russell Hills area in hopes of finding Jeremy. Volunteer firefighters and Aiken County community members joined in making the search's participants number over 100 people, according to past reports." End quote. They had officers canvassing the neighborhood, searching for any and every clue that they could. According to the Greenville News, Ray Grice, Jeremy's biological father, helped to comb the area nearby the house. He reportedly kept calling for Jeremy through all hours of the night. They even had a state-owned helicopter helping with the search. They were doing everything they could. They were afraid that he had drowned in one of the ponds nearby, so they drained 2 ponds entirely in the search for him. After 3 days, though, the police decided to look at the case in a different light. Maybe Jeremy had been kidnapped. And on that note, we'll be back after a short ad from our sponsor. Before we get back into Jeremy's stories, I want to hit you guys with some facts that I think are pretty relevant to this case. All of my facts and figures that I'm about to talk about are from the Polly Kloss Foundation. They're a California-based nonprofit that I am in no way associated with, but I like facts and figures, and so while I was researching information for this case, I came across their website. They've been awarded the Missing Child Nonprofit of the Year Award by the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. So they're definitely legit. Completely off topic, but is it just the millennial in me that wants to say too legit to quit after I say legit? No? It's just me? Okay, anyway, back to the rest of the information. The Polly Kloss Foundation has been around since 1993 and has helped around 7,600 families of missing children, and has worked closely with law enforcement to help bring missing children home. Statistically speaking, though, 99.8% of children who go missing
end up returning home. 90% of missing children have somehow misunderstood directions, or there was some sort of miscommunication, or somehow they are lost or have run away. 3% of children are kidnapped by non-family members, and only about 100 children per year are actually kidnapped by complete strangers. I was most surprised about the fact that half of those missing children actually come home. So children going missing and being taken by someone not family is not common. What happens in this story, actually, kids going missing is just not common in general. What happens in this story is not the norm. While it is important to be cautious and protective, I think we see a lot of stories on TV and probably podcasts that don't end well because that's what brings in viewers. Sure, everyone likes a happy ending, but they can't all be happy, at least not for TV. That being said, Jeremy is one of those kids who didn't return home. Jeremy was just 4 at the time he went missing. He was white with blonde hair and hazel eyes. He was just short, between 3'8" and 4 feet tall, and he only weighed 40 pounds. His nickname was Chris, and I can't find out how he got that nickname, but according to the Charlie Project, his nickname was Chris. In his pictures on the Charlie Project's website, he looks like a really sweet kid. A small, upturned smile. He looks pretty happy. The sheriff's office believed that Jeremy was kidnapped. But who had kidnapped him? They didn't know. As said by Captain Jim Whitehurst in the Greenville News just 4 days after Jeremy went missing, quote, "There is a possibility of an abduction since we have found no body, and that is why the FBI was called in," end quote. But even with the FBI's involvement, there was no arrest. I can't even find a mention early on of a suspect. There was just nothing. Jeremy's father commented in the item saying, quote, "I've claimed from the start it wasn't a total stranger. Somebody in that neighborhood got him. There's one road in there and one road out. There wouldn't be strange traffic in there on a rainy Friday morning. I haven't given up on him. And when he's found, it'll surprise a lot of people who's involved," end quote. This quote was from 2 years after Jeremy disappeared. Neither of his parents had given up hope that he would be found. There's a small comment in that same article that kept sticking out to me. Donna talks about a conversation between Jeremy and his stepfather a bit before Jeremy disappeared. Jeremy's stepfather had told him not to talk to strangers, which is totally normal to say to kids. I'm sure my parents said that to me when I was a kid. Granted, I was quiet, even to my family, so me talking to random strangers was probably not a concern. But Jeremy's response is a bit odd, to say the least. He asked if a woman could be a stranger too. It could have been an innocent question, but also, what if it wasn't? What if some woman had tried talking to him? Maybe after he was leaving school, or maybe even as he was playing outside. I can't speak for the 80s. I wasn't alive, but I can speak for the 90s and early 2000s when I say I was outside a lot. I probably should have been outside even more, but I usually had my head in a book. But kids just hanging out in the neighborhood was totally normal. Kind of like how people used to sit out on their front porches and just enjoy being on their front porch and people watching. I'm sure parents still let their kids go off and have fun, but I feel like overall as a society, we're a lot more cautious now. I mean, heck, we never used to lock our doors, but now I have to double check them before I go to bed. But back to the story at hand. This could have just been a strange question from a kid. Kids say the darndest things, after all. But part of me can't help think, but what if it wasn't? What if this woman, this stranger, was the person who took him? Soon, 7 years had passed since Jeremy had gone missing. Aiken County Sheriff Carol Heath unveiled a computerized age progression photograph done by Horace Hefner. Hefner was a retired FBI composite artist who actually had worked for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in Arlington, Virginia. At the time, Jeremy's photograph was the fourth that Hefner had done of a South Carolina child in the past year, and it was actually the 120th that he had done nationwide. Of those 120 photos, 11 children had been found directly as a result of Hefner's photographs, which is kind of incredible when you think about it. But I think the most heartbreaking thing about the age progression photograph is actually a quote by Donna, his mother, in the same Greenville News article. Quote, "It doesn't even seem like he should be 11. It seems like he should be 4. I think about how big he's getting. I wonder if he's having birthday parties." End quote. At the same time the article was written, May 1992, the police actually were working on a lead for the past 2.5 months. The suspect might actually know where Jeremy's location, where he was. The way it was phrased in the newspaper seems, at least to me, purposely vague. They didn't say that they believed he was alive or that they believed he was dead. They just had a person they believed knew his location. And whatever came of this person, I honestly don't know. I can't find any newspaper articles that mention anything about that after this brief mention at the end of an article. It was like 2 sentences, and that's all. What I do know is no one was arrested. There is another person who was looked at pretty heavily for Jeremy's disappearance. I can't verify if this was the same person the newspaper mentioned or not, because I don't actually have a timeline for when this person was looked into, but the Charlie Project talked about child serial killer, William Ernest Downs being questioned in regards to Jeremy's disappearance. I've mentioned the Charlie Project a few times, but I haven't actually explained what it is. The Charlie Project is an attempt by one person to document all the missing persons that they can in hopes of it functioning kind of like a database, both for publicity and for the public and law enforcement. There are currently 14,577 active cases documented on the Charlie Project's website. So they're really functioning like a database, and Jeremy's disappearance is one of the cases that they have covered. William Ernest Downs raped and sexually assaulted 2 young boys. He was executed by lethal injection in South Carolina in 2006. Prior to his execution, he was connected to both Jeremy's case and the disappearance of 9-year-old Tiffany Nelson, who went missing from Augusta, Georgia in June of 1994. Downs denied knowledge of either case. He would have only been a teenager at the time of Jeremy's disappearance, and he's never been charged in Jeremy's disappearance, nor in Tiffany's, actually. Even though Tiffany's case was officially declared a murder when her remains were found in 2005. It's now 2021, and Jeremy James Grice has still not been found. There is no body, nor is there any evidence that says he's dead. He may still be alive. We don't know. Jeremy would be 40 this year. In 2015, they did another age progression of him. There's a picture on my Instagram if you want to take a look. To me, he looks kind of like he could be a dad. I don't know, but when I looked at him, I could see him grocery shopping with a young kid sitting on his shoulders, and I can see him mowing the lawn and wearing, like, dad shoes. But anyway, I hope that somehow he managed to have a life. I hope that the worst did not happen, but regardless, the entire situation is heartbreaking. If by some chance you know something or have even seen the man in a picture or have seen him on the street, or you think that the guy who lives next door to you could potentially be Jeremy Grice, please call the Aiken County Sheriff's Department at 803-642-1761. In recent years, the police haven't really had many leads to go off of. Hopefully, somehow they can bring some closure to the family. The family deserves to know what happened to Jeremy. As always, I do want to make a few quick announcements before I go. I do the research for these cases all on my own, and I tell this podcast based primarily on newspaper articles I've read, interviews I've watched, online resources, the whole shebang. That being said, I may get things wrong, not just my pronunciation of things. I may get some of my facts, my figures wrong. I will try my best to be the most accurate, truthful storyteller about what happened to these victims, but I make mistakes. I'm human. I am definitely able, and I do make mistakes, is what I'm trying to say. But if you know otherwise about a case, or if you're related to someone in one of my podcast episodes and you want to have their stories further expanded, please reach out to me. All of the sources that I use for the story are in the show notes, and the theme song is The Journey Acoustic by Jal 2020 on Audio Jungle. Thank you for all of those who have listened since I started this. It just means so much to me. If you're new, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and please give us a 5-star review. If you have a case you want me to cover or just want to say hi, you can email me at eastcoasttruecrime@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at eastcoasttruecrime. I will attempt to update it fairly often. There will be pictures from this case there, but I am not a social media whiz. I'm not very good at it, and I've learned my lesson trying to be good at it. So you will have some bits and pieces of the cases, but I can't do what I was trying to do before. Anyway, thank you guys so much for listening. As I said in the beginning, we're going to be moving to a bi-weekly schedule, so you won't hear from me next week, but you'll hear a new story the week after. Bye guys, stay safe.